Today's daf in Masechet Ketuvot, brought to you from Yerushalayim Ir HaKodesh, is daf Ayin Tet. And we're holding right at the bottom of Ayin Chet, Amud Beit, an amazing daf. Hope you had a chance to review it and to get some of the amazing insights into the nature of the underpinnings of Ketuvah in terms of Mishpat and reality. Three lines up from the bottom. So this is a very interesting sugya. A woman wants to make sure that her husband does not take over her property. So she's trying to work it out. And this is like common kind of shtick for tax issues and so on. So what she does is she writes all of her property, gives it over to her daughter before she gets married. And then when the husband marries her, so it's not her property. So she doesn't get it. Now, the reason that this is so interesting is because until now, we've been assuming that if she wanted to opt out from the arrangement anyway, she'd be able to opt out. Because basically, as we said before in the Gemara, we're giving her the schus of the insurance against kidnapping, that he's going to be poda her in return for the peros, right? And since we had the klal before that any takana that is made for the benefit of an individual, he's able to opt out of. So all of these takanas for the woman, she could opt out of. So why does she have to hide the property from him? I mean, obviously you could say because it's very unpleasant to opt out and to tell him she doesn't want him to have his, you know, or maybe she doesn't want, she does want the insurance policy. However, here I need to let you know that in this particular case, there are many Rishonim who hold she cannot opt out. Why? Well, there's a number of different approaches. One approach is that she cannot opt out because then what she's doing is she's taking advantage of putting her husband into a position where the bottom line is anyway, he's going to go into debt in order to be put to her if she's captured. And it was in order to compensate for that, that he was given the property. In which case, this would not be normal that we did that in order that he should do that. In other words, it wasn't the quid pro quo in the Seder that we gave him the property for the benefit of the Isha. So over here, we're assuming the Isha will have a benefit. That's one possibility. Tosfos says, a possibility, that the reason that she couldn't opt out of this arrangement is because in other cases where she opts out, the takana isn't batal. Because let's say that she opts out of the arrangement of his supporting her in return for her salary. Well, what happens if she loses her job? She can just simply opt back in again, right? And in fact, he's mechuyev to be a mefarneser if it's not maspeket anyway. So the takana is never going to be bought to. However, when it comes to an insurance policy, now over there, that's ridiculous. You know, you're going to say, well, I don't want to pay life insurance right now because I'm only 20 years old, you know? I'll start paying my 20-year-old rate when I'm 80. Thank you. Thank you very much. So basically, no insurance company is going to take that, in which case, the idea over here is the same thing. Okay, so what's going to happen? She's going to go now for 30 years. She's going to take her risks at getting kidnapped. Okay, so now it's 30 years later. Now she'll start sharing the pears with the Baal. But the Baal was supposed to have gotten those pears for the past 30 years. So you can't opt back in at any point where you want, where you're going to be mafsid in 30 years worth of pears. Okay, that's Tosfos as far. But in any way, as I say, it is a big machlokas. And the question over here anyway is, of course, it would be uncomfortable. So she's trying to hide her property. So what happened? She gets married to him in Siva, and then he divorced her after some years. So at that point, she goes to Reb Nachman, you know, and she tells Reb Nachman, look, I gave this as a gift to my daughter, but I didn't really mean to give it as a gift. I meant that I just didn't want my husband to get the property, you know. So please have my daughter return the property to me because it certainly wasn't meant. Now, how we know that it isn't meant, there's a girsa in Rashi over here, which all of the Shonim don't like. And in fact, there are other girsaot in Rashi that she actually told the Aiden that she doesn't really mean that the star should be a real star. That is not the mashmot and is certainly not the way that most Shonim learn. And as I said, even in Rashi, it's not clear that he really learns that. But the point over here is that, as we'll see later on in the Gemara, Reb Nachman understood as a given that nobody gives away everything they own, leaving themselves penniless, because that, as we'll see, that was the case, even if it's a daughter. And in that case, he says it seems to be, on the face of it, just an approach to avoiding taxes, or in this case, it's an approach to avoiding the Baal's taking over the property. So sure enough, Kairi Rav Nachman l'shtara. Rav Nachman tore up the shtar. That is to say, he took the gift away from the daughter, and he said, listen, this is all fake. It's not a real shtar. And he forced the daughter to return the property. Anyway, Rav Anan was very angry at this, and he walks out of the Beznin, and he goes to Mar Ukva. Now, remember that Mar Ukva was, like we saw before, Mar Ukva was the top of the top of the Dayanim, and if Mar Ukva was going to threaten somebody with changing the din on him, he could do that. So anyway, so he goes to Mar Ukva, and he says to him, you're not going to believe this. This Rav Nachman guy, you know, as far as I'm concerned, this is with apologies to Ira, as far as I'm concerned, Nachman is a farmer, not a judge. So, do you see this farmer Nachman? Old Rav Nachman had a farm, E-I-E-I-O, because his psukim are ridiculous. Look what he does. He goes around tearing up people's shtarot. It's awful. Do something about this. Now, Mar Ukva says to him, as he usually does, easy, like, tell me exactly what happened, right? So, Emela, easy, gufa duvda ekahava. Just, I need all the details before I'm going to listen to your shouts about Farmer Nachman. Oh, Marley, this is what happened, achibachiava. He gives him over all of the details. So, Mar Ukva says to him, so then he's 100% right. Oh, Marley, what are you referring to? You're referring to an obvious shtar mavracha. That's called a shtar which is there to hide property. You're trying to get it away from her husband. That's what you're talking about. And for this, you're calling him a farmer. I mean, Hokyom Reb Chani Loi Baridi Yom HaShmuel. This, look, Shmuel says this, you know. I am a Meira Heira, meaning that I have rishus from, even from the Reish Galusa, that I am backed up by the government, and that they don't do that for just anybody. They do that for people who, even if they're going to make a mistake, are able to maintain their psak. Im yavo shtar mavrachat liyadi, and I'm telling you right now, if anybody would present a shtar mavrachat, which is what we're talking about over here, I'll rip it up. So, I mean, he's got, Rav Nachman's got some pretty good backing over here, Rav Anan. What are you going crazy about? So it's very interesting because the Chofetz Chaim brings this in the Dinim of Lashon Hara and so on. So he points out that, you know, first of all, when you're talking about Rav Anan over here, I mean, Rav Anan was a guy we're going to see later on in the Masechet that Eliyahu HaNavi used to speak to him. I mean, he's not just a nobody. And this is the way that he reports it. So you see from here that, okay, as far as the way that he speaks about Rav Nachman, and this we saw already, that the issue of chasing after the MS, the Tzlach, Rechava, Dvar MS, these people used to kill each other. That doesn't bother us so much, because that's accepted, accepted interactions when people are the Dioraisa, the Ratachle, it's the terror that gets them angry. But look, says the Chofetz Chaim, look at Mar Ukva's response. That here's this somebody that's telling him this, who is Zerche Tegilui Elio, you know? And you don't accept what he says. You try to cool him down so that he can see it from a different perspective. So he says, say it over to me, quiet-like, and let's discuss it. And sure enough, when he discusses the whole thing, Rav Anan recognizes that he's made a big mistake. Says, that's exactly how to deal with such things. Instead, what do people do? Oh, my God, it's terrible, and this is terrible. Sit down, discuss it, figure out maybe there's another way to see what happened. And this should be a lesson for how to respond to people who are telling you over these horrible things. Amalei Ravel Rav Nachman. So meanwhile, back at the ranch, you know, so this is what's happening in the background. Rav Anan ran out. He goes to speak to Mar Ukva. But back in the Bezdin, we still have Rav Nachman sitting there having torn up the shtar. So what happens over there? So Rav said to Rav Nachman, why'd you do that? Time am I? To lo shavik inish nafshe. Now, I understand why you took for granted that's why the Rashi, as I mentioned earlier, is very problematic. So I understand why you assumed that this was a shtam rav lachat and that therefore it should be torn up because we have an umdana. People don't give away everything they own, leaving themselves without anything to support their own lives with and giving it to somebody else. So it's obvious that this wasn't really meant to be a binding transaction. Okay, but I mean, isn't that true if it were to a stranger? I mean, isn't it possible that this mother could really love her daughter, trusts her daughter, that her daughter's not going to leave her without taking care of her? And so she transferred everything that she owned to her daughter. Is that so crazy? Are you so sure, therefore? Avala Barta Yahiva, maybe she would do such a thing for her own daughter. Said Reb Nachman, people aren't that stupid. Afilo Achi, no way. Bimkom Barta, even in relative to the care for her daughter, a normal human being cares about their own survival and will not do such a thing. Nafsha Adifala, she's not going to take a chance on trusting a child to take good care of her. And therefore, for sure, if she gave away everything, then it's got to be a shtam rav lachat. Problem is that there's a braita that seems to say, not like this. If a woman wanted to actually be mevarachat her property, keeping it away from her husband, what could she do? Well, she could be kotevet shtar pasim la'achirim. She gets somebody that she trusts. Remember, pasim, we've spoken about many times, shtar pasim comes to the lotion of piyusim, pasim piyusim, meaning that she, there's somebody that she trusts and is mefuyas with, that she can, she feels that I can be mefuyas someone to please help me out, take this from me, you know, and, you know, I know you would never screw me over and take it away from me and so on. But I need to keep it from this guy. I'm marrying. It's my second marriage. I don't really know what he's going to do. Take my property from me. So it says, Rosh Hashanah Gamaliel. But the Chachomim say, ha ha, that dear friend can laugh all the way to the bank. Let me tell you, he would be mitzachekba. So he could just laugh his way all the way to the bank and keep everything she owns forever. Now, I don't think that's such a very smart idea, Reb Shimon ben Gamliel. The only way that she could protect herself is by writing into the shtar that I am giving you this gift from this moment at the time that I officially approve the gift, but I still have to think it over. Okay, so then that means that she's always keeping for herself the right to either approve the shtar or to cancel the shtar. So then if the guy tries to keep it from her, so then she says, I never approved the shtar. Show me where I signed onto this subsequent to writing the shtar. So he can't keep it. If the Baal tries to take it, she can say, listen, she signs the shtar and then she shows it to the Baal. Now, the question is why that doesn't itself screw her over. There's a big discussion about whether this is always rescindable in terms of the circumstances. So in other words, if she did that when the Baal tries to get it, she can always show the Bezdin that, note, I never approved it until this bum went ahead and tried to get my property, you know, and vice versa. So the question is, can she constantly bounce them back one against the other? There are many who actually say that she can't. There's she would have to write that. But the kasha from the Braita, of course, on Shmuel, is that you see that the only way that the shtar would not be valid is in the event that it contained that clause. And it does not contain that clause over here. And so who gave you the right to rip it up? So time it a katva lahachi. But halo katva lahachi kanan hi lokeach. Omer Rebbe Zira, that's not a problem at all. Because remember, the only reason that Shmuel knew that it was a shtar mafrachat, as we said, is because who does that? Who gives away everything that they own? Oh, everything that they own. Well, the Braita wasn't talking about everything that they own. The Braita said if a woman has a particular piece of property that she wants to keep away from her husband, she can always pull this shtick. Okay, then you don't have that same umdana that it's ipso facto a shtar mafrachat. There, Shmuel would agree. Obviously, everybody would agree to that. Reb Nachman would never have jumped to the conclusion that that's considered to be a shtar mafrachat. So therefore, ha, bekula. So where did Shmuel say that din? Well, I would rip it up if I got one. That's where it's obviously one. Mashenkin, the Brisa, is talking about a particular piece of property. That doesn't mean she left herself without anything. And in that case, unless she writes this special clause in that allows her to keep her pulse on the property, then it would, in fact, be a kosher thing. Wait a minute. I don't understand. If you're telling me that innately it doesn't work until she signs off on it, right? So then that means that when she got married, she owned it. So at that moment, the husband gets it. So what did she accomplish? If you're putting off, I understand that technically speaking, when she does sign it, it's now going to affect it retroactively. But by then, he's already kena it, and therefore she should lose her right to retroactively engage the shtar. So what good is it? So then in the event that in the end, he doesn't get it. So if in the end, he doesn't get it, then the husband did get it. And then that would mean that he would inherit it and everything else that is, goes along with it, right? So nekninu baal. Omer Abaye, asa'um kenechasim she'inam yedu'im labaal, Rabbi Shimon, which Tosus takes to mean, as I mentioned to you yesterday, we pass like Rabbi Shimon. It doesn't mean if you hold like Rabbi Shimon, it's the Alibid Rabbi Shimon, because that's the way that we conclude. And because of that, it's as if he didn't know about the property. Now, this is very strange. Once again, I mentioned to you some Piske Halakas that were Nogea from Rabbi Meisha, and this is another one of them. He takes this Gemara to mean a very powerful understanding of the sugya, which is, look, normally, if you have the rights of Yerusha, you do not need to know anything about it in order to be a Yoresh. Yerusha is automatic. And therefore, there should be no affecting of an actual Yerusha if we're talking about a case like this, where actually he didn't know, but so what, right? So Rav Moshe's Mechadesh based on this Gemara, that the whole idea of the Yerusha over here is different, because the concept is that he had no kavana to be Yoresh, and in that case, he's not like a normal Yoresh. They gave him the schus that he can be Zocha in the Nechasim of his wife. And if he is Zocha, which Nechasim is he Zocha to anything that he would be considered a Yoresh. But remember that the Yerusha is not a Diraisa. It's part of the Takana. So then what was that Takana? The Takana was that he has his chus to the Yerusha, but he has to be Zocha in it, as opposed to the automatic nature of a real Yerusha. Since over here, he did not think that he had a right to it, if it was eno yodua, so therefore he doesn't get it. More than that, once we say asa'um kinechasim she'enam yodun, it doesn't mean that he didn't know. It means that since in general, had he not known, there wouldn't be a zichus. So a din of a mavrachat is similar, and we give it as if it was nechasim she'enam yodun in order to allow for mavrachat. That's the point. There's something illegal about the Mavracha. It's a way in which she can essentially partially opt out from the arrangement that Chazal offered her. So that would mean that even if you hold like those Rishonim with which we predicated our discussion today, that this is one issue in the Ksuva, since it's insurance, it's mandatory, which is quite reasonable if you think about it. So if it would be mandatory, I mean, what, are you going to come back to us? It's like somebody who says, I don't need health insurance. Okay, says the government, you don't need health insurance, but then when you get sick, you're going to come to the government to take care of you. So therefore, your health insurance is mandatory. Or get yourself a policy. But you can't have it both ways, to throw yourself on your husband, so to speak. In this case, throw yourself on your husband, but not do anything towards paying for that insurance, right? So that makes sense. But in order for her still to be able to deal with particular issues in which she's, so to speak, opting out, because I don't want to share this property, and he doesn't even know at that time that he's supposed to be getting that property, that's fair. Because ultimately, We would have given her the general din of opting out anyway, except that because of the nature of the insurance, or she has to get some of the payer, so to speak, so that the takana shouldn't be batal. Okay, that, I think, really puts it into a nutshell what the various issues are in this particular case. I think it adds a great deal to our understanding of the way that the ksuva would work and how it would be possible for allowing some level of opting out while still providing the insurance that the ksuva is meant to apply. And now,
what is Rebbe using to opt out of drinking every few minutes?
The fact that I'm being Isaac Batera with the Rabbim, and that Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi was even willing to embrace people with Ra'as son, Kol Shekein he would have done with Mayim b'Mishura Tishteh, V'Ala Aretz Tishan, U'Batera, and so on and so forth, and he would opt out of interrupting his shir with drinking, I think.
But
so
I was.
If you can get Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi to testify that he drinks along with Gavi every time Gavi comes to visit the Kever, and that therefore I should drink along with Gavi. And there we go with Akiva and with Richie, who's right there. But of course, I can't drink his kind of stuff in the middle of the shir. But oh, look at this. Alon's joining us. So then I would, every minute, every other minute, if you can bring Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi to tell me, I'm happy to drink every, whatever he says goes.
I'm going to bring Rebbe's grandfather, and Rebbe's not going to like it. So Rebbe's grandfather gave shir for 8 hours straight in England and then could never stand to give shir again because he wore himself out from giving shir nonstop without dealing with his physical needs. We don't want that to happen.
Okay, then I will promise Beli Neder not to give shir for 8 hours without drinking. But there is a little bit of leeway between 8 hours and every other minute, I think. So, you know, let's keep it to a medium, as the Rabbi
says. Gears grind. As soon as I hear gears grind.
Derech ha-emtzait is always the right way to go. And we'll call in even Aristotle if we have to.
No, I'm calling the Rambam to go to the Katzeh HaSheni and then gradually balance.
Outside of Shir, we'll do the Katzeh HaSheni. Anyway, we're ready for a special happy moment. And take a look at Zoom. I mean, this application is, I mean, the most astonishing application of artificial intelligence in the world without letting on. It's done it again. There's Doc right on top of Richie, threatening him. I mean, it's like beyond belief. And Richie's going to have to do a good job. There we go. Enough lulak safim. All right. So now we talked about nichsei malug, and we talked about what happens if a woman inherits nichsei malug, and we talked about winning the lottery and stuff like that. And what it is that we should do, we make investments, the husband gets to eat the pay raise, and so on and so forth. Now, we want to go through various issues of how something is actually parsed in terms of its being pay raise of nichsei malug, or is it directly nichsei malug? What exactly, let's talk about various cases. She inherits somebody's cash. Okay, so now what do we do with that? So then, obviously, that's our first simple case. You buy property, and then the husband will be oichel peres. So this way, we guarantee her, and it's dafka karka, in other words, we guarantee her keren, so that's the principal, is protected by virtue of our investing in real estate. It's not going to disappear, and it's not going to get worn out. And he, therefore, is going to be able to take care of eating the peres. And what's more, we're going to see that we've got another issue as the Gemara develops. And that is that the very fact that he's eating the peres means that he's caring for the property, which is very important to us. Because, I mean, even if you're talking about real estate, you can ruin a field. And that is going to create various problems, la halacha, in the event that he wants to turn this field into cash for himself by giving it out to sharecroppers or whatever. Will they take proper care of the field? All of that is part of the takana. It's not so pashut that it's just a question of her owning real estate. It also has to be cared for real estate, as we'll see. So you look at them karka. Now, suppose she inherits peirot But these perot are already tlushim in hakarka. So then here is the idea, which is brought out so beautifully by the Mishnah. When we say who ochel perot, some idiot would think that means who ochel perot. Stupid. When it says who ochel perot, it means he has the income of the property. It doesn't mean he eats fruits. What a fruitcake you are. So therefore, if she inherits fruits, obviously, we turn the fruit into money, buy a piece of property, and then he can eat the perot. He can't eat real perot. Whew. Okay, so it's a beautiful way of illustrating what these words mean. That they're, of course, they're abstractions. They're not the fact that he gets to eat any fruit that she gets. It's very humorous the way that the Mishnah does it, right? So if actual perot fall to her, then we sell the perot and we buy property and then he eats the perot. But the perot means the perot of that property. Now, here's the issue. Suppose she inherits perot and they are at this time still attached to the field. Now what? So these are the perot of that field, but they're not the perot of this field, which he has grown. So when we say he eats the perot of the property that she has, does that mean he can invest in the property and eat the perot? Or does it mean if she has property, which she does have in this case, and there are perot from the property, that he gets the perot? Ah, now we're talking a little bit more subtle than the obvious cases that we spoke about before. So what do we do in this case? Amar Rabbi Meir, here's what we do. We have to see kama hi yafa biperot, the kama hi yafa below perot, umotar yulakak behem karka, vuhu ochel perot. This is not so poshut, says Rabbi Meir. Because if she inherits and it continues to grow after she inherits it. So now how do we make that analysis? Because I'm saying the part that does indeed grow from the time of her inheritance, he gets to eat. But the part that was there as part of the inheritance, he doesn't get to eat, even if it was perot. That's still Karen. So how do we decide what to do? What we do is we take the value that the land would have been worth for sale at the time of the inheritance without anything growing on it. And then we take the value with the whatever was growing on it at that time. We subtract one from the other, and that gives us the value of the crops that were there at the time of the inheritance. And then we subtract that from the value of the total crops at the end, which then that represents the part that was grown afterwards, and that is what he keeps. So, in other words, he has to pay, so to speak, that difference to her, and then he keeps the payroll. And that will be actually a very clear-cut distinction between perot that are partially perot and are partially karka. So this is, of course, a much more sophisticated and more sensitive way for us to bring out the difference. So that would mean that difference between the values, the husband has to invest in purchasing a piece of property, which then is added to her nechsei malug, and he can eat the produce of that property. Okay, very clear, everyone. Are we happy? Do we get a thumbs up for Rabbi Meir? Come on, show Rabbi Meir a little bit. There we go. Okay, but the Chachomim disagree, and the Chachomim say, Hamechubarim lekarka shelo. Basically, we look at even perot that are going to be detached afterwards, that we do not have to make this level of distinction. If it was attached to the ground, so then when it's detached from the ground, we view it in a very primitive way as produce, perot. But if it was real produce, meaning that it was already detached from the ground, then it's not produce. And in that case, indeed, as we said at the beginning of the Mishnah, we have to put it in to karka. So that would be the only thing that would determine it, not all of these complicated analyses. Rabbi Shimon Omer, what this actually means, if you think about it, is that wherever he gets the upper hand, so makom sheyafekocho beknisata, when he's marrying her, if he has the upper hand to be zocha, then he has no rights when he divorces her. Urakocho beitziata. I'm going to explain this in a minute, says Rabbi Shimon. So hold your horses. Makom shehurakocho beknisata, and where he has the, he's basically at a disadvantage, then he gets the upper hand at the time of the divorce. And what do I mean? Ketzad. Okay, so imagine a case like this. We're talking about, like the Chachamim said, a peirot and a mechubarim lekarka at the time of the marriage. We said, according to the Chachamim, that this is his. Ah, but in that case, if he divorces her and he there's still tvua that's there, or peirots that are attached to the trees on her nichse malug, she takes that along with her actual property because he hasn't been zocha in it yet. And therefore, it's still growing. It's not the time for his zechus, and it belongs to her. On the other hand, let's say that she inherited at the knisat lushim min hakarka. So then we said, oh, well, that goes to her and has to be translated into a fund, which is not, we don't really believe in trust funds. And therefore, we don't allow you to put it into a trust fund. You have to put it into property, but we'll call it, right, as if it's a trust fund for her, and he is able to eat only the peirot. That's when she's coming into the marriage. But when he divorces her, if he already had taken these peirot off of the karka, he was already zocha them, and therefore at the divorce, it's his. Okay, so let's just talk about, because the Mishnah made it very clear, it doesn't like investments in Google. Okay. So what? How do we define a better investment? Because, I mean, the truth is, I must tell you, there's a machlokas we've shown him about whether we're talking about mutuality in the determination of the investment, or we're talking specifically about where the husband wants one type of investment and she wants the other investment, not the other way around. But, okay, so let's just, what we're talking about over here, they are fighting with each other. What shall we do with the money that was inherited, or with the peiros that we sold, which turned into money, which were inherited, to ensure her principal? It says in the Mishnah, buy karka. Now, suppose one of them wants to buy houses as opposed to karka. What is a better investment in terms of protecting her money? The idea over there is land, because that is the best protection. It is not liable to deterioration the same way that a house is liable to deterioration. And therefore, if you hold like those Rishonim who say either of them can taina that they want the most secure, he can say, listen, if I'm meant to inherit these things if you die, so I want them better protected than you. You're getting turned on by this beautiful mansion. I want to make sure that we got the money. Okay, as I said, sometimes it's only she who has the right to say, listen, you're coming to protect my Karen. I'll determine what the protection of my Karen is. Okay, but whichever one we learn, the Gemara is saying, look, it's clear that land is better protection. If you've got a choice between homes to buy or investing in palm trees, I remember the palm trees we saw have many special dinim in Bavel because of the way that they were actually almost like mamish currency and long-term investments. Everything was done with palms. Nonetheless, homes are a better investment because they're certainly going to last longer normally than a date palm is going to last. Let's say you've got a choice between palm trees and other kind of fruit. Buy palm. If there's a choice between buying other fruit trees versus gifanim, then by Ilani. Now, Tosis points out that there's many Gemaras that make it clear that the profitability of gifanim is greater. And so why over here are we saying to buy other things? So Tosis explains, as all of us know, that when it comes to the amount of work that is necessary for making gifanim profitable, it's a tremendous amount of work. And it's true that if you're able to put in that work, it's going to be more profitable. But over here, where we're talking about just the investment per se. We don't know what's going to be with the amount of work that is going to be put in. It's better to have the Ilani. And this, as our own expert, Ira, will tell us, is the reason why he's got all those olive trees. Okay. You wouldn't want to have to quadruple your work. You got problems enough with your olive trees. So therefore, Ilani. So then, if you have something that is usable and it's also, it's not going to wear out, and that falls to her, so then we say that should be kept. So now, is it clear all the time what should be kept or what should be sold and reinvested in pure property? And that's not all that clear. Let's say that she inherits an Iba of Zardata, or she inherits a Pira de Kavri. She's got a fish pond. Now, a fish pond is renewable. An Iba means a forest. An Iba is a whole forest of Zardata. Remember, these Zardata, basically, these were the trees that the Shadim didn't like hanging around at and so on. So these Zardata are, they're renewable timber, so that they're usually used quickly and they're replanted and so on. So how do we look at that kind of thing? I mean, a fish pond, obviously the fish are not going to live forever, but, you know, you constantly renew it with fish. Same thing as tree of the Zardata. There, it's in Machlokas, whether we view this as Karna directly or Pera. So some say this is just Peras. It's not Karen. So the question is, how do we look at the wood, or how do we look at the fish over here? Is it the production, or is this what it basically consists of? So if you hold it's considered to be the Karen, then we don't sell it because she's already got herself Karen. And then that would mean that the Baal is going to be using the income of the fish and so on. And that would mean that he can take all the fish and say to her, okay, now I'm divorcing you. You take care of it yourself. Or he can cut down all the wood, divorce her, and say he's eating. So what happened to the wood that was mine? Wasn't the wood that was yours. It was the forest that was yours. Okay, so that's good for the Machlokas. Because the other way of looking at it is that the whole thing is called Karen, because it is renewable, but you have to put in to renew, and therefore you have to sell it, and you buy property, whatever. Okay, so basically the klal is, we just need to determine what's included within this. If gizo machlif, again, gizo machlif means that it is, again, it's a specific term, but it is an abstraction. So gizo machlif, as applied to trees, it generally means if you cut down the tree, it will regrow. Some trees are gizo machlif and some trees are not. But we're not talking necessarily about trees over here. We could be talking about fish ponds. So if something is gizo machlif, if it will on its own regrow, so then it's considered to be pira, because it regrows exactly the way that a tree grows fruit. But if ain gizo machlif, and you have to be the one who's going to invest in making it again profitable, that's considered to be karna. Omer Rabbi Zera, Omer Rabbi Shaya, Omer Rabbi Yanai, or some say Omer Rabbi Abba, Omer Rabbi Shaya, Omer Rabbi Yanai. The halacha would be that if somebody steals the vlad of a behemas malug, he pays kefel to the wife, which is very interesting. Because what it's saying over here is that if she owns an animal and the animal has a child, then that child, it seems to be saying, is considered to be her additional Karen, as opposed to his rights to Peros. So now, who is this going according to? I mean, it doesn't seem to fit anything that we know about the definition of Peros versus Karen. It's not going, not a libet Rabbanan, not a libet Hananya. What is that machlok? That's the Tanya. Vlad behemat malug goes to the Baal. Ooh. That was what we just said is not the case. We're going to give the woman the payment. And the kefel, v'lat shifchat malug le'isha, whereas if she has a shifcha, and that shifcha has a child, that goes to her. Now, that doesn't seem to make sense, but the Gemara will explain it in a moment. The Hananya ben Achi Yoshia Omer, the asu v'lat shifchat malug kivlat be'mat malug. It's not true. both of them, the Drabonim Rumitaken, go to the Baal. But it seems that everybody agrees that the vlad of an animal, Malug, is considered to be Paris that goes to the Baal. And therefore, why should the Kefel be paid to her and not to him? Says the Gemara, it's not a problem. He could agree with everybody over here. And I'll tell you why he does not get the Kefel. Because the Takana of the Rabbanan were to get the Peros, but not to get the Peros that get out of the Peros. So the Kefel is Peros of Peros, and he wasn't given Peros of Peros. Now, we know that this is ridiculous, because we've already had before that the only way that he can opt out of taking her Peros is he has to write, Din Udvarim Ein Li Lo BePerot VeLo BePerot, Not Sof Kol Olam, which means that he does get Peros. So Tosfos explains that this is not to be confused with that case. Peros obviously includes the Peros for however many generations. I mean, that's ridiculous. This is what the Peros are generating. What would that mean? We only give him the right to the fruit directly, but if he plants that fruit and gets a tree, then he doesn't get, come off it. Of course he gets Peros. We're talking about the specific quality of Peros that are not part of the natural pre. The payment of Kefel is coming out of left field. That's not something that is innate in the child of the behemoth. I'm going to say every child of behemoth includes the Peros of somebody stealing it and having to pay Kefel. That's silly. So that is what it means over here. That type of thing, secondary adjunctural payments, that doesn't go to the Baal. They only were mitakein normal things. But of course, normal things include Peros and Peros as well. Even if Baruch Avram is having a hard time keeping that head up, this is a heads-up notification. So therefore, pere de pere, lo takin ale. Now, wait a second over here. I just want to understand. I understood, Hananya, that we say that all types of offsprings, whether it's an animal, whether it's a shivcha, are the same. Because why are they given to the husband? Because lo chashin alamiza. He says, look, what's the problem? The problem is that we need to assure ourselves of the security of the investment that will make certain that she has that Karen, correct? And if you're talking about livestock or you're talking about a shivcha, I mean, unfortunately, anything that has the word live attached to it, as Shlomo HaMelech points out, Kila Kelev Chai Tov Min Aryeh Hamet. And therefore, what good is this animal going to do her if it's no longer alive? So what he is saying is, we are not worried about the death of the item, neither in the case of the shivcha, nor in the case of the behemah. Now, Rashi understands, we're not concerned with the death of the item, because there's always something that is going to be left that she is still, you're going to be nene from, which in terms of the behemah, would include the skin of the animal, and so on. Okay, so, which of course does not mean, as they talk out that he, as we're going to see in a minute, doesn't mean he has a right to shecht it and so on, but it just means that they are, we're not worried about it. That is, the Rambam doesn't learn anything like that. He just simply learns that, look, we know that eventually it will die, but we have no idea if that death is going to be impactful at all on her, do we? I mean, what if she dies first? And then it's a question of her never having been affected by the death, and it's only the husband's business anyway, who is going to be Yorish. We can't say that that means that ipso facto, this type of thing does not serve as the principle that it was when she inherited it. But according to the Rabbanan, it doesn't make sense. One way or the other, if you hold that we are worried about things that are alive having to remain alive, so then that would be true even of a Vlad Behemat Mulug should not be given to the husband because maybe it's needed to take the place of the Karen if the mother dies. And on the other hand, if they're not worried about Misa, so then the Vlad Shivchas Mulug is exactly the same. Answers the Gemara, no, they are Chayesh Lamisa, but there's a difference between a behemoth where there's a, or and what's going to be left behind if the Shifcha dies. And therefore, if there's going to be something left, then that's a partial protection of the parent. Omer Avuna Bar Chiya Omer Shmuel, we paskin like Hananya, that the husband actually, as the Rambam paskins, that the husband actually would get it. Omer Rav, Omer Rav Nachman, Afag, Rav Yomer Shmuel, Alokha Ki Hananya. Hananya himself is made that in the event that the Baal took the child and then he divorces her, she can buy back the child. Why is that? Because a servant is considered to be Shevach Beit Aviyah. And as we've seen before, the idea of Shevach Beit Aviyah is that a woman has a particular emotional connection to anything that came with her at the time of her marriage from, or if she inherited, from her father's home. And therefore, if this was the maid that had been with them for 30 years before and is an indication of how choshev the father's home was, that they were able to maintain all of these servants and this was given to her, and she says, look, I understand that legally you can take this, but I want to pay you because to me it means something. She has the right to pay back, even if it doesn't want to. Mipnei shevach beit avia. Omar Rava, Omar Ibn Nachman. There's another thing. So let's say she brings in nichsei malug. She's got a goat. This goat is good for giving milk. A sheep is good for its wool. Or she's got chickens, a tarnagolet the beit sata. Or she's got a dekel for its peirot. What's the din over there? In these cases, the husband can continue to eat the peiros. Ochel v'holech ad shetichle hakeren. So even though we'd say, well, wait a minute, I mean, if he's going to take everything, eventually this chicken is going to die. So, I mean, shouldn't we be setting aside a certain portion for the guarantee of her principal? And therefore, we should use always a sort of trust fund so that we build up the possibility of replacing it for her, shouldn't we? I mean, why would we say that we don't have to sell it? Or at least make sure that somehow she's protected. Why do we continue to eat it until the bitter end? And that way, there would be no way to really protect her. So again, the svara over here is that these things leave something or other that provides for her. If the date died, the tree dies, there's still the value of the wood. If the chicken dies, she can still sell the feathers for pillows. I don't know how many of you remember the old days of Meir Sharim, where that was a major, major income. Everything was made out of those feathers. They would make the mattresses out of the feathers. Okay. And then I know personally about this because my uncle was actually in the chicken business. So, in the old days, back in Meir Sharim. Well, the same thing would be true about if you're talking about the body, the skin that's left. We said that's also considered to be something that's left. So therefore, even though what we said is that we're going on Libet Hananya, the idea is, according to Rashi, we're trying to make this true according to everybody. Omer Ibn Nachman, Ayla Lake Lima. Let's say that what she brings in is her Nichsei Malug, is a beged. She's got a coat, let's say. So then that's considered to be, wearing it is considered to be peros. And therefore he can continue to wear the coat, even though it becomes unwearable after a while. Why don't we say that that's considered to be a consumable and therefore the equivalent of peros that were naflula? Because there will always be something left over. There's always the worn out material that has value. Keman hi tana. Tanya, Hamelach v'Alchol, fascinating issue over here. So this guy is married to a woman who inherits, let's say, a sand pit near the sea or a salt pit where the tide comes in, leaves salt behind. Now there's tons and tons of salt there that have been there for hundreds of years. Those are considered to be utilizing the salt or utilizing the sand are considered to be peirot because basically, we don't say that we have to sell the whole thing just because, well, ultimately, if you use it up, what's it going to be worth? We don't say that. We say that there's always something that is going to be there that still will provide for her. But what about a mine? So you've got a pier shall go free, an open mine from which we're mining sulfur. Or you've got an aluminum mine. Sorry if they used to use the alum, remember, even before they could process the aluminum. So machpore shel tsarif, those are things that are used up. They used to use the tsarif itself for dye. And we had many cases where alum is important. So there, lemaisa, we are going to use it up. Obviously, mines, one of the big problems of mine, they become depleted. But I mean, there's going to be land underneath it. What's the din? So Rabbi Meir says the sulfur and the tsarif is considered to be keren, and therefore you need to invest that. The Chachamim Omrim payroad. So there's the question is a little bit of something left behind considered to be enough to turn what's coming into payroad? Or do we say, no, it needs to be significant? Okay, so that means Reb Nachum is going to leave the Rabbanan, who would say whatever it is that's left behind, that's fine. Rabbi Shimon Omer, Mokam Sheyafek Kocho. So he goes through this whole thing that, look, you know, wherever he has the upper hand at the time that he marries her, he loses his rights when he divorces her. And he speaks out the difference between Perot HaTlushim or Perot HaMechuburim. What's the Chiddush? I don't get it. Isn't Reb Shimon basically saying the same thing that the Tanna Kamma said, who argued with Rabbi Meir, and they say that the Perot that are Mechubur at the time that it comes in are considered to be entirely his without doing this fancy analysis of Rabbi Meir. So that's what he's saying. Amar Rava, it's not so simple, because nobody discussed what the idea is of mechubarim when they get divorced. Mechubarim b'shat yitziyah ikebinayu. There is a big difference, because note that the Chachamim and the Mishnah never said a word about what the din is of peros that are on the tree at the time of the divorce, right? And that's the difference between them and Rabbi Shimon. Because Rabbi Shimon says that goes to the woman, as he said. But the Chachamim would still hold that whatever grew during the time that the husband has the rights to the peros are his, even if they're still attached at the time of the divorce. So that is a major machlokas between the Tanna Kamma and between Rabbi Shimon. And we actually figure that machlokas because of the fact that Rabbi Shimon said it, which brings us to another very important Richie moment. Well, that sounded like a Richie from the old days when he was Zen. You started off with that. I like that. Just don't let it take away from the Zark Bahilika Mishnah itself.
So close to you to Rosh Hashanah.
Yeah. So enough, Lula. Okay, so now we've got our next Mishnah that continues discussing the various inyanim that are inherited and what we do with them. How about if she inherits avarim ushvachot who are old, and therefore we do have to worry about their dying? Then you've got to buy something that is endurable. And who will help her? Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel Omer, no. She doesn't want to sell them. She does not have to sell them, because by definition, avadim ushvachot, this is the old butler who was with her father for 60 years. You can't sell him just because he's 103. And therefore, she wants to keep him around as Shevach Beit Aviyah. How about if Naftu Lazetim will give Fanim Zekenim? What if the trees are old? Yimachru Vila Kachbehem Karkav Uochel Perot. Rabbi Yehuda says even trees that she inherited from her father are the old olive trees that we've had for so long, and they're called to her a emotional investment, Shevach Beit Aviyah. Amar Rav Kana, Amar Rav. The whole machloket over here about whether we consider olives or grapes, that's dafke besoda shalah, they fall to her together with the property, not that she was just inheriting the rights to trees. There is a concept of the right to trees, as you will recall, we've had many times. Somebody can buy a tree for its payroad, and then he doesn't own anything in the karka in which the tree is. The tree dies, and he's out. There's nothing that he's going to own. And therefore, what we're talking about over here is the Shevach Beit Aviah, where there is a field that's going to remain hers. But if a soda is not hers, so then that means the land belongs to somebody else, and the husband wants to invest in something that's durable. Everybody agrees that's not called something that she has a right to say, well, I'm emotionally attached. There, for sure, Mishum de Kakalya Karna, the husband says, well, what good is this? I mean, it's not going to last for more than a couple of years. Maskiv lo Reb Yosef, I don't understand. And what about the old Eved and the old Shivka? And why is that not going to last more than a couple of years? Isn't that like a Sada She'ena Shala? And they do disagree. So how do you explain that? Sorry, I should have said it differently. Yid marach yid. But Omar, Rav Kana, Omar Rav, machlok et besadeh she'ena shala. The other way around. If it was in a soda which is hers, for sure everybody's made it. She does not have to sell if she doesn't want to. There it's definitely called Shevach Beit Aviah. It's not just a tree. It's basically the old property.